right. The March 14, 2017 hearing of the Oregon House of Representatives Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now in session. We have five, which I might add, the best five of the eight here today. So we actually have a quorum so we can move forward. We're going to do a couple of things today, but one of them we will discuss at the end of the meeting today, just to confirm whether or not we can actually schedule House Bill 2140, which has to do with the notification for seismic before sales. There was supposedly a work group, but supposedly not. And I'm a simple to mind, so I need to know whether it's okay or not. That's what we're going to be doing. Okay, so
there's
please, we're going to invite up. I'm going to invite up. was this in particular order? Because this is opposite.
I think there's some next.
People have to leave early? Okay. So we're going to ask Raquel and Denise Barrett and Keith Mills. Please come up.
I think they're a part. I think Denise is actually.
Okay. Denise can wait. But these two folks can come up. And we don't let this worry you, but we generally do a 20-minute per panel. That doesn't mean we're going to like have a giant hook come out or anything. It's just going to be we try to make sure and monitor things. So please state your name and what you do for the record and make us smarter.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I'm joined here by
Keith Mills, State Engineer for Water Resources with the Water Resources Department.
Great. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair. So today we're going to talk about the Oregon Water Resources Department's role in emergency preparedness and response. We appreciate the invitation to come talk to your committee today. We were asked to provide a quick overview of what our agency does generally. It's great to see some familiar faces here. And then we'll talk briefly about our role in emergency preparedness and response and move into a little bit more depth on drought and dam safety and then some future work here that's going on during this legislative session as well. These are both drought and dam safety are rather big topics or can be big topics. So this will be a fairly high level and quick snapshot of both of those issues. So the Oregon Water Resources Department is the water quantity agency for the state. Primarily, that means that a lot of our focus is around administering water rights and managing water rights, and then also permitting. A little water rights 101, this is probably the quickest 101 I've ever done, is that Oregon is based on the prior appropriation system when it comes to water management. So what that means is it's first in time, first in right. We have water rights that are over 100 years old. And so the older your water right during times of shortage, if there's not enough water to go around, the senior rights, those older rights, get priority first. And we actually do go around the state and shut off junior users, those newer rights, in some areas of the state every year. So I bring this up because it feeds into the drought conversation that we'll have here shortly. If you note the map on this slide, it shows water availability. So when we talk about permitting new allocations of water, you'll look for the purple on this map, and that is what water is available for live flow during the month of August. You'll note that you're having a hard time probably finding that purple on the map. So with the exceptions of some areas within the Willamette Valley and sparse out throughout the rest of the state, there's not a lot of new water available for live flow during the summer. And of course, that's important when we have the conversation around drought. We also administer the dam safety program here for the state. We also manage the well construction program. So we set standards for the construction of wells and abandonment of wells. We also license well drillers and conduct well inspections. So that's another public safety program that we have. And then our water quantity data, both surface water and groundwater data, is used both by our agency as well as other agencies in the state. And then we do have some grant and loan programs as well, really around water resources, projects, planning, and studies. And then, of course, there's probably some other actions that we could talk about today, but we'll skip over that the agency does do in regards to helping Oregonians both meet their current water needs and future water needs. In regards to our role in emergency preparedness and response, most agencies, I think, here in the state have some role similar to ours in the statewide natural hazards mitigation plan. So this is really led, the development of it is led by DLCD, and we take a lead role as that plan is being developed particularly. So we have quite a bit of involvement on that. And then in that really helps us assess risks and vulnerabilities as well as existing data around these natural hazards and what we can, what actions we can take to help mitigate those natural hazards. In addition, again, probably most agencies, and you've probably heard this, have some role in emergency response, and those efforts are led by the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. Our role particularly in that we have a lead role when it, in partnership with OEM on drought response. And you're going to hear quite a bit more about drought response because we have actually had drought quite a bit here lately.
Excuse me, I have a brief question. For debris removal, is that DLCD or is that you? Debris removal in rivers and lakes.
Chair Evans, that is a great question. It's not us, and I can't think of who does that.
Chair Evans, generally debris removal in non-emergency situations is Department of State Lands.
In emergency situations.
In emergency situations, it may go through the Office of Emergency Management directly, and the Department of State Lands could probably better answer that question.
Thank you. Good.
So we have a supporting role for other hazards, as do probably most other agencies, but particularly our groundwater and surface water data. So surface water data, for example, our stream gauges are used in understanding what the level of rivers are. So if we're looking statewide, if we're looking at floods. We also have our dam safety program, which we're going to talk more about today. And then our well construction program is another public safety program that we also have here in the state. So drought is, as I noted, has been a very important topic for the department, and other committees actually have spent quite a bit of time on drought as well in recent years. And we do, this is a quick snapshot of probably the longer conversation around drought, but we do expect to see an increased incidence of droughts occurring. And that's in part because Oregon is very reliant on snowpack as a storage reservoir. And so as we see temperatures increase, that snowpack is disappearing. That's our natural storage system. And because of that, we're expecting to see increases in the likelihood of droughts occurring. And we'll touch more a little bit about that because that's what our 2015 drought was. In terms of drought declarations, it's important to distinguish between the federal role and the state role. A long time ago, it used to be that you needed to obtain a state drought declaration in order to get a federal disaster assistance. At least on the topic of drought, that is no longer the case. So the drought, the feds have actually implemented a more automated process when it comes to their drought response tools. And so the state's process is separate from that. In regards to a state drought declaration, so the governor would issue a drought declaration through an executive order. And usually that starts at the county level. The request goes to a committee called the Drought Council. And the Drought Council then ultimately makes a recommendation to the governor before she issues an executive order. So if she were to issue that executive order, there's really two different authorities. There's the typical emergency response authorities under the Office of Emergency Management, and then there's our responsibilities, which are under our statutes. And those provisions really are more focused on drought specifically as opposed to the typical emergency response actions. And typically what we see being used within those tools are really for existing water right holders, that's important, is either emergency drought permits, those are temporary permits that we can issue in an expedited manner, or what's called temporary transfer. So if they want to shift where their water is being used to their highest value crops, they can do that under an expedited system. So those are really the drought response tools are limited in nature, and in part, if you think about it, if you're in a drought and there's not a lot of access to water in the first place, it's really hard to respond to that when there's just not water there. So the 2015 drought was one of those. It was pretty significant. If you look at the slide here towards the right, there's these maps, and they show what's the U.S. Drought Monitor for Oregon. And I'll note that the red on the map is extreme drought, and the orange, the darker orange there, is severe drought, and then you get to the lighter color, which is moderate, and then yellow is abnormally dry. So I think one thing that's important from these is that you can see that unlike other disasters that we commonly think about, drought occurs a little bit more frequently in the state. So here you can see, though, that 2015 really was the year that was very significant from a drought standpoint. And as you can see, there was extreme drought in many areas of the state, including the coast. So that's an area that tends to experience drought less frequently. And then even on the western side of the state, in the Willamette Valley and on down, it was in severe drought. And there was a number of things that happened in 2015. One, if you recall, I was talking about snowpack. Well, snowpack was the key issue in 2015. We had record low snowpack. We also had record high temperatures. And then we ended up getting, I guess, the perfect drought in that we ended up having lower than normal precip. Which it didn't start out that way at the beginning of the season, so rainfall. So even though during the winter we had fairly normal in terms of precipitation, all of it fell as rain instead of snow. And that's where we ended up having a lot of challenges and low stream flows across the state. And as a result of that, it certainly taxed our department from a response standpoint, primarily because, as I noted, the response tools are fairly limited. And really what we found was the best response was communication and outreach. So a lot of the newspapers were very interested, and citizens were interested in water conditions and how they could do their part. So it really did end up, I was pulled into doing this off of other responsibilities, and some other staff ended up being pulled off their responsibilities to focus on this issue. So the 2015 drought, fairly significant for us, and we learned a lot. As a result of that, we worked with the Oregon Legislature and the Governor's Office, and in 2016, a task force bill was passed, House Bill 4113, which established the Task Force on Drought Emergency Response. And that task force worked very hard, met over a couple months, and came up with 13 very good recommendations. That report was distributed to the legislature in November. Certainly, if any of you would like another copy, I'm happy to send that over to you. And given that I want to be sensitive to time, I won't step through all those recommendations other than to note that there's a lot of good ones in there. So I think one of the takeaways when we're talking about drought is that really we do need to focus on long-term resiliency, and that's one of the themes in the Drought Task Force, as well as we're also working on updating our statewide integrated water resources strategy. And really what we need to do is focus on assessing what the impacts, you know, making sure we have the data in place to understand what's going on, but then being able to assess the impacts and vulnerabilities, where's the most risks associated with drought across the state, and then be able to plan for those risks, and finally implement actions so that in advance of a drought, we can prevent those impacts from occurring as opposed to having to rely on response actions. And we'll provide at the end of this presentation some examples of what's already being done on that front. In regards to dam safety, it's important to understand that there's actually two different, we have state regulated dams and we have federal regulated dams. And so we, for efficiency purposes, do not cross over on those. So there's about 280 dams that are regulated by federal agencies. They have their own dam safety program and conduct their own inspections. And then there's there is our programs that we have. So the Oregon Water Resources Department does not own dams. We are purely on the front of regulating them. So there's about 960 state-regulated dams. In order to be a state-regulated dam, it needs to be 9.2 acre feet, which is just over around 300 or 3 million gallons. Did I get that right? Okay. And 10 feet tall. So that's what it needs to be, both of those things, in order to be a state regulated dam. And what that means is that we then inspect those dams on a regular basis. It's also important to note that there is a difference between condition and hazard rating. So condition of the dam is fairly clear. It's, you know, is it in good condition? Is it in poor condition? Is it in unsatisfactory condition, for example? The hazard rating doesn't have to do have anything to do with the condition of the dam. It has to do with what's downstream. So a high hazard dam, if you look downstream, if that dam were to fail, it would likely result in loss of lives and property. So Oregon has 77 high hazard dams right now. And that's, of course, where we want to focus our inspection efforts. So those ones, we try to get those inspected every year. Ones that are lower hazard, it's less frequent inspections because there's not that same risk downstream. The department also reviews designs and plans for new dams or repairs. We also, as resources allow, develop flood inundation analyses. These are particularly helpful in developing emergency action plans, which can identify what would be inundated if the dam were to fail, and also helps us then in developing these emergency action plans in collaboration with the owners of the dams. Be able to identify from an emergency response standpoint of what emergency response personnel need to be concerned about. And then we also, as resources allow, assist landowner or dam owners with seismic evaluations. So that's the high level of dam safety here in Oregon.
So I'm sorry, one more question. We often hear about the not so great condition of our public infrastructure. 77 high hazard dams. What condition are the 960 as a whole? Are they in about the same as public infrastructure, a little better, or at the other end of that their scale?
Chair Evans, I'll probably look over to Keith to answer most of this question. In looking at the high hazard dams, for example, we have seven that are in unsatisfactory condition, and we're working with those landowners to get those
and they're privately
get those
owned?
Repaired. It varies. So some, I think one's a county. I think there's a one that's a municipal or a couple that might be municipalities, and then there's a couple that are privately owned. So I think probably the short answer is that I don't know on the 960. I know on the 77 that it's distributed. So there's some that are in unsatisfactory, being the seven that I just mentioned, and then there's some that are in much better condition. Keith, do you have anything to add to that?
Chair Evans, members of the committee. In general, our infrastructure is getting older, and some owners have really are able to address their infrastructure needs and rehabilitate their infrastructure. Other owners have not had the resources to do that.
So, and again, just for the record, that's Keith Mills, engineer with Water Resources, answering that question.
Correct.
And what I'm hearing is that some folks know they have a problem and don't necessarily have the resources to try to fix it, and the conditions of the dams, like everything else, are getting older as a general rule. Is that fair?
Chair Evans, that's a correct statement.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry. One more question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The high hazard dams, are they required to have an EAP on all of them? And also, how often do they get it inspected? And do they have early warning systems?
Chair Evans and Representative Lewis. So Oregon, if it's a, I don't know when this requirement went into place, but on new dams, they are required to have an emergency action plan for those high hazard dams. On existing dams, and again, I don't remember when this requirement came into effect, we don't have authority to require them to do an emergency action plan. What we have been doing, though, is working with those landowners, even if they're not required to assist them in helping to get those emergency action plans developed. So we've been working with them on a volunteer basis, and my understanding is we have over 50 of those 77, I want to say it's around maybe 55, that have emergency action plans developed. We certainly would like to see that to be all of them.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. So of the total high-hazard dams, how many are privately owned or on private property, approximately?
Chair Evans, Representative Lewis, I'd be happy to follow up with you on that in the committee. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head.
Okay.
And in regards to your other question about inspections, we inspect those annually, and I think you had for the high-hazards, and I think you had a third question, and I failed to write that down.
Well, the other had to do with early warning systems and how many have an early warning system in place. If you could come back with that information, that would be helpful or provided.
And we have a question from Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 77 high hazard dams, I assume that's the ones that are state controlled. Doesn't include any that might be, just knowing the federal dams and the position of downstream, the potential for life, they're not included in that number whatsoever.
Chair Evans, Representative Lively, that's correct. We're just talking about the ones that are under our jurisdiction. And certainly something that is important to note, I think, for us is that those federal dams, they have a good, generally a very good inspection program. Yeah. And dam safety program. And when you think, probably if you're thinking about a dam in this state, probably the most common one, whether you're on this side or the other side of the state, is going over the pass, Detroit Reservoir, for example. That is a federal project that would be, I think it's the second largest in terms of height in the state. So when you're thinking about really big dams here, in all likelihood, it's probably one of those federal regulated dams.
Just a request on the materials that you can get to the committee and we can get to Representative Lewis. If you could also, on the breakout of private and public, we may not be able to tell privates what to do. We may have to negotiate, but we can absolutely tell publics what to do. So if we could have the names even of the publics that don't have, let's just say those that are not yet completed with their emergency action plans, we can help motivate that. Please continue.
Okay, so Just as a looking at what we're working on this session as well as down into the future, as I noted previously on drought, but I think this is applies to all hazards, in even including with dam safety, is we do want to invest in these longer-term actions for resiliency so that we can properly plan for drought and other hazards and then really be able to take actions in advance instead of being in response mode. We do have our statewide integrated water resources strategy, and that strategy was developed in 2012. We're in the process of updating that, and one of the recommendations from our policy advisory group really focuses on reviewing dam safety, and so I think there will be more information that will be included in that 2017 update, as well as extreme events and recommendations around what we need to address in that arena. We'll also be focusing on implementing the recommendations of the Drought Task Force. And then this session, if you look at our budget, and I know we're running out of time here, so I'll just note that there's several packages in the governor's recommended budget that implement actions of the Drought Task Force. There's also a package in there that uses dam safety fees and federal funds to for a dam safety engineer to continue a position that we've had as a limited duration position. That one's very important to being able to continue to conduct these inspections. And alongside that is House Bill 2295, which is really our water rate transactions fee schedule, but it's a fee schedule for as well for our dam safety program that increases those fees, and those ones are already in Joint Ways and Means. And then finally, there's one that's down in House Agriculture and Natural Resources. That's House Bill 2297 and 2241. That we've been talking about potential legislation related to implementing actions of the Drought Task Force. So there is certainly is a lot of work that we're doing this session, and if you have questions about any of those items, I'd be happy to follow up with you. So thank you.
You did exceptionally well, and I wasn't going to say stop because we asked some questions in the way and want to make sure you have full time. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you showed the picture of the drought in 2015, which was all of that red, so much it was red, and you talked about, so in a drought situation, one of your roles is to go out and, I guess, enforce who has rights to whatever water is left. So I'm trying to understand how that's actually accomplished when you have a map that looks like that.
Chair Evans, Representative Lively, we had a lot of regulation going on in 2015 is the short answer. So we have 21 water masters.
Okay.
And so they're divided into 21 water master districts. Some of them have assistant water masters, and that's actually one of the proposals in the governor's recommended budget is to increase those resources. We also in some cases have been able to partner with counties to get additional resources there. But on the eastern part of the state, the prior appropriation system is fairly well understood from the standpoint of every year regulation happens. It's just a matter of how far back we go.
Okay.
In a year like 2015, we went very far back.
Sure.
So, and when I talk about regulation, yes, there are parts of the state where we're regulating water rights back into the late 1800s. So this is a very old system, a very old body of law. And so certainly during that year, we did a lot of regulation. If you then looked west of the Cascades, we also were regulating streams where we, our water masters, had no recollection of regulating. Really? It was a very significant year from that standpoint.
Thank you.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I really hesitate to ask a question since I am late, and I apologize to you for being late. You ever have one of those persons in your office that just doesn't take a hint?
Yes.
It's like,
yes.
Raquel, I came to apologize to you because I missed your presentation. Welcome to a different version of rural land use and water, because we got to know Raquel very well there, and we know and love her well, and for her very scary reports about how we have no water in Oregon. So would you mind starting over, please? I'm kidding.
Love to come meet with you.
Yes, and that's exactly what, if you would. Was this similar to what you presented to us? Oh, I think it was it September or July?
Chair Evans, Representative Post, certainly we talked about drought, and you are very well versed on that, given that you've had much more in-depth presentations in the former committee. What we haven't talked with you about is dam safety, so we'd certainly be happy to come talk to you about that if you'd like a short briefing on that.
But we did promise some of your money to make it better.
You did what?
We did promise that Kaiser will help make the dams better. So.
Oh, absolutely. We have our own water supply, so in Kaiser, you can't have any.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. And again, if you can get us those materials, that would really be helpful. Appreciate your time, and thanks for your flexibility.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Now we're going to call up Ms. Denise Barrett, Manager, Regional Disaster Preparedness Organization. Come on forward.
Thank you very much.
And again, I won't dock any time if it's our questions taking time from you. Representative Lewis?
Yeah.
Could we pass those things down so Representative
Post
can see them? We have some visual aids. Proceed.
Yes, Chair Evans and members of the committee, it's a real honor to be here today. For the record, my name is Denise Barrett, and I am the manager of what's known as the Regional Disaster Preparedness Organization of the Portland Metropolitan Region.
Which used to be known as?
Well, I'm not going to say that it was formerly, but I will get into that it did incorporates the urban area, the Owosse grant area. So I'll talk about that in a minute.
Great.
So we are a regional collaborative partnership of public sector, private sector, and nonprofit sector agencies. You can see on the slide there's a number of counties. More than a dozen cities, special districts. We also have partners in our region from Metro, Port of Portland, TriMet, federal and state partners, universities, and so on. On the private sector side, we're a little light, but we're hoping to grow that over the years until a corporation sits on our steering committee. We also have members from the utility companies, PGE, Pacific Core, Northwest Natural, Hospital Systems, and so on. Good old Red Cross is there, as well as the Oregon Food Bank. We are in the five-county region, includes Clackamas, Multnomah, Columbia, and Washington counties in Oregon. And then we're a bi-state organization. We also incorporate Clark County in Washington State, which always makes things very interesting. In addition to what you see in terms of all these jurisdictions and other partners, within jurisdictions and these agencies, we have a range of first responders, fire, law enforcement, public health, healthcare system, emergency managers, public information officers, and others. Our mission is, and I'll go into what this means a little bit in more detail, but basically it's to build and sustain regional disaster preparedness capabilities in our region. We do that through strategic planning, investments in equipment, training, and exercising our first responders and our plans, and also upgrading technologies when and where we need to. We come from a long history in our region, which I'll get into in a minute, but of basically having an ethos around coordination and an understanding of how it can be of value to our partners. And it includes the fact that, as we all know, that many disasters do not really obey jurisdictional boundaries, right? They're always pushing jurisdictions and agencies beyond their capabilities. And so our region is really taking that regional approach to planning and preparing in order to help our partners help each other and also receive state and federal assistance as well. Our vision is really to create a secure and resilient region, and that's a long, long process, as we all know. We have to take things slow and understand that it takes a long time to get to the next phase of things, and sometimes you never feel quite right that you're getting there. So a little bit about our history. Long before I came to Portland, and I came in 2011 to start my job and the organization, there was the, in 1993, what was known as the Regional Emergency Management Group, and that included a policy committee and a group of emergency managers from our region. And so that doesn't, as you know, really encompass all of the different disciplines that really need to be involved, nor all the different levels that need to be involved in preparedness. But it was a good effort, and it was a group of jurisdictions that had an intergovernmental agreement. And then 2003, post 9/11, the establishment of Homeland Security and the Homeland Security Grant Program, this Urban Area Security Initiative was established, and our five counties were designated as a UWASI, or an urban area, and started to receive a lot of money. There is a blessing and a curse to receive a lot of money. When you're not really prepared to really handle money, sometimes there's a lot of money that goes into things that maybe you regret 10 years, 15 years later. But essentially, that's where we started the UWASI program. So the REMGI organization remained, and the UWASI organization remained. And then some people got switched on to the fact that maybe it would be better if we had something that was a little bit more integrated and encompassed a vision and a set of sort of duties and responsibilities that I think really would pull us all together. And so this RDPO visioning process happened in our region 2008 to 2009. I was hired in 2011 to stand it up, and we established some priorities in 2013. And in 2015, we actually formalized the organization through an intergovernmental agreement and a local cost share, which sustains part of the organization, and that's my position. This is how the structure looks. If any of you know Washington County Emergency Manager Scott Porter, he loves to call this the blue pill. As soon as I came on board, I said, please, let's not call it the blue pill. But essentially, this gives you a compressed snapshot of our organization, which is really four levels of governance. At the top is the policy committee, and that's our elected leaders. They are representatives from jurisdictions that have signed our intergovernmental agreement and choose to be on the committee. Some jurisdictions choose not to be on the committee. At present, 14 of 20 of our jurisdictions, counties, cities, and regional governments have representatives on that committee. And they're really helping to get their political weight behind the organization and also to make decisions around policies that help sustain us or help us to build consistency in our preparedness in the region. Our steering committee is at the next level down, and those are executives from both jurisdictions that have a right to be on that committee, as well as some discipline groups like fire, law enforcement, public health, emergency management, and some others. We also have some private. This is where private sector begins to show up, as does nonprofits in our organization. The program committee is really the chairs of all of our discipline work groups. I'll get into that a little bit more later. And this is just a snapshot. You might see some familiar faces there in terms of the leaders that are on our policy group from our five counties, three regional governments, City of Portland, and five other cities. We do have a vacancy from Clackamas County when Chair Ludlow was not reelected last fall, so he's being replaced. Again, our steering committee, these are the group of not elected leaders, but executives. They are really responsible for helping us to chart a vision and a focused, integrated strategy for our organization. The program committee, representatives from our work groups, help to translate that strategic plan into projects and initiatives that together make up our work plan. And this is what I like to do. I like to unpack the organization so you can see. You can't really read this very clearly.
But it's very pretty.
But it's very pretty. And it looks like a whole constellation. I mean, we are sort of a galaxy. It just means that there are so much. I think it represents just how complex preparedness really is. I come from a background of working internationally as well as in the U.S. on post-disaster. So I've been a responder. I was in the recovery process for Katrina, and I worked in Africa and other places. So I've seen a lot of disasters. And now I'm on the other end, which is preparing or helping to our partners prepare in our region. And it's very complex, and it covers a lot of different grounds. And as I said before, I will get into some of those capabilities that we're building in just a second. Getting more to the point of our funding, we continue to receive, or we have in the last couple of years, the Urban Area Security Initiative. Why I say the last couple of years is because we lost our funding in 2013. I'm not sure how much I want to get into the complexity of actually being a region that qualifies for UWASI funds, but safe to say that we are compared across the country with 99 other metropolitan statistical areas on our risk and threat profile. And with that, we also have to wait until Congress makes a determination on the amount of funding that will be available, and then the Homeland Security Secretary has to make a decision about which number of or how many UWASIs will actually get funded. So in 2013, we fell off the rails. Our risk profile fell below the threshold. And that was a good opportunity, actually, for the RDPO, because it was at the same time we were trying to get our partners to forge an agreement and to keep the organization going, and they started to contribute. Actually, for the first time, it was historical that our partners now fund at least my position and some of our projects. It's not enough to run a whole program, but at least keeps the wheels on the bus, as they say. Building and maintaining capabilities. I've given you a snapshot of some of the slides. We do a lot of planning. We also do a lot of investment in training and exercising and equipping a range of tactical teams, like SWAT teams and hazmat teams. And also the water providers are doing a good job in trying to come up with alternative potable water supplies. With Metro leading our charge on disaster debris. Chair Evans, you had mentioned that earlier about debris. Our regional partners are looking what are the interconnections between them in terms of planning for debris removal, post-Cascadia subduction, or other kinds of big events in which regional partners will have to cooperate and collaborate. We're also really strengthening emergency operations center staff to be able to collaborate regionally, and setting up a regional coordination mechanism, which is at times a little bit difficult because people are a little bit afraid the more they have in the response area to be asked to coordinate. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult. We also, on the citizen resilience side, it's a really important area of our organization. We support jurisdictions who are preparing community emergency response teams, Medical Reserve Corps, and some other community-based initiatives. Messaging, public messaging, too, is also a very big part of what we support in our organization. We've also, our policy committee, sort of made our own declaration, our strategic plan, that we are going to continue to support or advance equity efforts in our region. And five of our emergency management agencies in the region just concluded an assessment of their ability to provide support for people with disabilities and access and functional needs, as well as engaging those folks in the planning process itself. And now there's an action plan that they're doing on the local jurisdictional level, as well as we have some regional goals as well to advance. In terms of successes organizationally, we've been able to sustain some of the organization through partners' contributions. I think the next one is one of the most important things, which is that elected leaders in our region are much more engaged and aware and are taking on this preparedness very seriously, which I think is really great. We also have a range of new partners in our region, within our region as well as with state partners, and I'll talk a little bit more about those partnerships in a minute. On the programmatic side, there's quite a range of things that we've been doing in terms of forging new groundwork, including this coordination system that I was talking about before. a list of those things right there. I would say the last one, shared workers agreements, is one of the things that when I first came aboard 5 years ago, it had been on a list for 20 years, which is to be able to, in the event of a disaster, if your staff are stranded and can't get to your agency, or in this case, it's the Emergency Operations Center, that other emergency operations centers will take them in and let them work at those centers. So now we have an intergovernmental agreement for that, which is great. Just take a sip of water. We have a number of partnerships around the state, and I thought that might be of interest to you today. One of them is with the Oregon Department of Energy. And this fall, we intend to partner on an emergency fuel tabletop exercise, which will be showing where the gaps are in our planning in terms of the immediate response post disaster, in which we're going to have an understanding of how we're going to get fuel, especially if the central energy infrastructure hub is debilitated. So this is part of what we would call mitigating and planning for some emergency response fuel mitigation. Another partnership that is also evolved is with Dogami, and that's for earthquake mapping and impact analysis. So we're trying to work with Dogami to be able to get stronger data that will help us in mitigation planning, not only on the local level, but I believe it will also be useful for the state in terms of earthquake response, recovery, and also mitigation. Another partnership which is important to us is the Oregon Department of Justice. You may or may not have heard of the Titan Fusion Center. This is an intelligence center that fuses information and tries to create a picture for us of our threat risk in our region as well as across the state, because it is a state agency. And we have one analyst that we fund in that center that helps provide our law enforcement with information and intelligence. Another area, we've already heard about Oregon Emergency Management. They cut across a lot of our work. It would include our work in preparedness messaging to help to create consistent messaging for the public. And also, I am based in the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management with my job, and that's the agency that is the fiscal agent for our UWASI funds, and OEM is our state administrative agency. A couple of other partners before I talk about this would be we've developed a partnership with OSPAC, and that's been really important for us to be able to see where there is legislative issues that of interest to us that we might advocate for, as well as the State Resilience Officer, Mike Harriman, who I know has been before you before. Part of our strategic issues, we have four critical issues. One is critical infrastructure, and we'd like to see legislation and coordination on the central energy infrastructure hub, which I think is one of the biggest issues that we face and keeps all of us up at night, is where will fuel come from post-disaster? Another
could,
area is community yes.
Just for a second.
Sure.
I believe, and I could be wrong here, we're trying to look it up, but House Bill 2889, you might want to familiar yourself with.
Yes, I do know about that.
Okay.
But I am not at liberty to really truly advocate specifically on bills. So
just to keep you informed that part of the process is aimed exactly at the area that you're showing on the picture. So.
Yeah, we're excited about that actually.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure. So I was going to say on the community resilience side, we're very interested in more funding and coordination with our state partners on preparedness messaging. We have some of it going, but I think we can do a lot more on that area. Another area, and I know that there has been some legislation considered, I think it was House Bill, or was it Senate Bill 808 a couple of years ago on mass displacement. Mm. We ourselves in our region are looking at what we can do regionally on mass, what we call mass care and shelter planning, and we would really love an opportunity with the state to have a task force in place to make a much more concerted effort on the state level, and we will be a very good partner in that. Another area that we're very interested in on the community resilience and preparedness messaging side is hoping that we do get an earthquake early warning system for the whole of the Cascadia region. We would be already in a position to support a concerted effort on this game-changing technology in terms of preparing our communities with messaging and what they can do differently based on having that system in place. Another area, of course, we're interested in the earthquake side, but we're also interested in flooding, which is also we're at great risk in our metropolitan region. And we've created a partnership with the Levee Ready Columbia program, and are very happy to support them in all their initiatives to make sure that they're getting their project fully funded and completed. And last but not least, we couldn't say that this was not an issue. Funding always is an issue. I know it's an issue for everybody, but we are always interested in on the federal level to make sure that we are funded. We are looking at how we can sustain ourselves more with our own partners' contributions, but it would be difficult for us to lose our federal funding at any time, and it seems like that could happen. Last two slides are really to let you know that we are a learning organization as well, and together with the State Resilience Officer are going on the Japan Best Practices trip, which Greater Portland is organizing. I'm not sure if any of you are going on it, but our plan is to bring back the learning and share the learning in our region, and I'm sure the State Resilience Officer will also share it with you. Another organization that we have an emerging partnership with is the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, PENWAR. And they're having their annual summit in Portland this year. We've partnered on the development of their Disaster Resilience Symposium, which is a within that summit is a two-day set of workshops specifically tailored to audiences that are interested in resilience planning. And that's July 24th to the 25th at the Marriott in downtown Portland. Thank you for this opportunity.
I have a request while people are thinking of potential questions. When you get back from the Japan trip,
yes,
if you could share with us what you learned,
mm-hmm,
even informally would be helpful.
Sure.
And while you're there, hypothetically, if you happen to run into any engineers or any folks that have learned a lot and want to share, if you could ask, again, hypothetically, if they were to build a tsunami center, would they put it on a sand spit at Yaquina Bay? It would be helpful to hear what the Japanese engineers said.
I will do that for you, Chair. Thank you.
Any questions?
A specific point to that question.
Specific point is Japan has learned some hard lessons. I would like to think that we can learn from them. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much
you very
for
much.
Coming forward.
Appreciate it.
And again, appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. The next panel, we're actually going to invite both up at the same time, and you'll actually get to use the sand hour twice.
All right.
So 40 hours for that, or 40 minutes for that, but less if you want. You all are going to be explaining a project. Come forward. It's okay. Come forward. Explaining a project that you partnered in Ohio and show us some technologies. And we've had today so far the discussion about what we need to do with water resources, drought concerns, dam concerns. We've seen partnerships and progress in planning. Now let's see some of the tools that do it. So please step forward, introduce yourself, and tell us what you want to tell us.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman, and our elected officials. I appreciate the time to talk about this. I'm Russ Monk with High Impact Technology, based in Willamette Valley here in Salem and in Tigard, and we create technologies to protect critical infrastructure and our troops, and we've exported worldwide.
My name is Lauren Lader, Vice President of Knife River. Our work for Knife River Corporation Northwest, which is based in Portland, actually Linton, just west of Portland. I office out of our Harrisburg office, and I live in Springfield.
And you guys build big things.
And we build infrastructure.
Okay.
So a good way to frame this is we're the kind of the technology innovation part. They're the horsepower in a lot of the things that we do. So I want to show honor in that.
So what he really means is we build stuff and he blows it up.
Fair enough.
And through the course of this, you'll get to see high-speed video out in Central Oregon of things going boom. Do I just hit forward or back? Okay. So 13 years ago, we were handed a problem by the U.S. government in Iraq. They were actually targeting all the fuel tankers, lighting them up with the bullets being shot into them, bleeding them out, and then they would catch, with incendiary rounds, they'd catch the whole tanker on fire. And that was spilling out onto the convoy, so it wasn't just the tanker, it was the entire convoy, so we were getting hammered. There were National Guard units that would actually not follow orders because they were getting targeted so aggressively. 32-foot billboard in a hot zone, you know, how do you miss that when you can hit it, you know, like that? So we were tasked to come up with a solution for this, and the original idea was to put armor on the trucks. The weight of the armor was so heavy that we basically said, let's, you know, we're going the wrong way here. could we create a coating that would go on the outside of the fuel trucks? If they were shot, they would instantly seal and never let it leak out. So let the bullet go through, just don't let it leak. That's what we pitched to the Army. Army liked the idea. 3 days later, the head engineer was on our doorstep here in Oregon. There's a ballistics lab, one of our sister companies here in Salem, and liked what he saw. A week later, we were at Aberdeen Proving Grounds showing off the technology, going through military qual tests, and spraying 5,000-gallon fuel trucks at the same time. It went from a raw idea to military approval in 10 days. And then 3 weeks later, we were in Kuwait setting up the first factory to retrofit all the trucks going in and out of Kuwait. And then that factory moved up into Balad, Iraq. And what I'm really proud of is that didn't exist. This is a brand new technology that we invented right here in Salem and Tigard combined. And we've been able to change the world with that part of it, protecting the troops. So that tanker, imagine that. How do I get to the high-speed camera? Do I?
The mouse.
Okay. So one of the beauties of having a ballistics and blast lab as your sister company is we're not working at this point. Okay. Is all the testing and all the validation can be done locally. All right, we'll just go through the next one here.
Yeah. It's really cool when it goes through, though.
Yeah, and it seals in less than a second. And then there's a reactive chemistry. The part of the invention was when the fuel tries to spit back out, we use the fuel as a catalyst, and it locks the wound down and doesn't let it leak. One of those big fuel hauling trucks in Iraq ended up with over 600 bullet holes in it, and all of them sealed. So one of the other critical things, let's see if this will work on this video. Nope. Okay. How can you destroy a gas tank? You blow it up, you shoot it, you blow it up, you burn it up. And we have a technology, the video would actually show a high speed or a test being done, 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit, and we can protect the fuel tankers from that as well. So, you know, fire, bullets, and then blast. Let's see if these will work. It looks like we're not working, so I'll just have to walk through it quickly then. An unprotected fuel tank, the one that would be on the top right-hand side, it just incinerates. It just explodes, and there's about a 40-foot fireball from that explosion. And we will have a thumb drive of this that I can give the committee afterwards if this doesn't, you know, if that doesn't come together.
If people go to your website, they might be able to.
Most of that is on there, and then we can go that way as well. But the ability to protect fuel tanks, every vehicle, you know, whether it's an airborne vehicle or a fighting vehicle or a tanker, all have gas tanks. And if the insurgents realize they can shoot at the gas tanks, you actually can take out the war effort, is what we did. The samples that are floating around, like the one that's here, my representative post, that's an array of different bullets. The bullet, if you turn that over, the actual shot came in from the outside. And if you turn that around, that's where the bullet went through, and it instantly seals, and then it locks the wound down and doesn't leak out. So that's the base technology that we invented. I'm really proud to say that we've exported it to 12 countries now, and we won the President's Export of Excellence Award in 2016, the first Oregon company in 22 years because of our success of being able to take this technology abroad. State Department defines where I get to send this technology, and I get phone calls that I have to say no to, so fair is fair. So this is just a good example of some of the other technologies. We've invented armor systems that have actually been used in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the different military fighting vehicles, including the bottom right-hand side. That's an underbelly for a landmine technology that we invented as well. I'm very Oregon-centric. You know, my supply base is really, I like it local so we can innovate quickly. The steel that came from that was made out of Oregon Steel Mills, which is Everez now. It was actually laser cut locally and then fabricated locally, and then our special coating systems are sprayed locally as well. But we also had to invent the technology in a way that you could pick it up and move it anywhere in the world and be able to produce it that way as well. So that's just, you know, it's a neat hybrid of what we do. So about 3 years ago, when Congress was throwing, federal Congress was throwing grenades back and forth and shutting down the U.S. government, we had already made the soft pivot. What else could this technology go to? And we said critical infrastructure is what we really think we could help with. And that, the tanks that we have right here, the Fukushima disaster in Japan, what happened is they had a design criteria for an 8.0 earthquake. They got a 9.0. They had a 30-foot or 20-foot seawall. They got a 30-foot tidal wave. And the actual reactor at Fukushima shut down exactly as it was supposed to do. But what happened is the holding tanks are up on the hill that were gravity-fed, the fresh water that could blend in and flow down into the cooling, were ruptured in the earthquake and split open, and they didn't have that. So they had to flood seawater into the Fukushima reactor, which killed the reactor and created a catastrophic mess. The Japanese government came to Oregon and tested here in the Willamette Valley the ability to tailor this to a water effect, and we actually have a water variant and a fuel variant that would work well. If you look, think of the holding tanks that are right there by the St. John's Bridge, that anchor point where most of the fuel comes in from Oregon, you know, that's right there. If someone lit that up, it would shut off a chunk of the fuel coming into Oregon and it would shut down the Port of Portland. So, you know, thinking, you know, there's minor applications like for a single fighting vehicle, and there's major applications for critical infrastructure as well. I don't think our video will work on this way. As a technology development company, we actually have invented 12 different technologies, and we've commercialized 8 of them now. And so I'm really proud to say that. I think the spark that is in Oregon, that is part of the technology innovation hub that we are, the ability to take that technology and move it abroad is a part of that. The C-Bar is actually a factory that's here in Salem, and it's a composite rebar that is actually twice the tensile strength of steel, one quarter the weight, and won't ever rust. So think of the Roman arches that were built 2,000 years ago. If they had steel rebar in them, they would have died a long time ago. Today, that's one of our technologies, and we've incorporated that into a number of our applications in that.
Sure.
Yes, good.
What's the cost for the production of those compared to the steel?
It's about 1.5 of an epoxy coated right now, but we're not in major mass production. That would come down if you're in huge production. But if your bridge lasts, you know, 3 times longer because the steel's not rusting out, the cost is cheap at that point. I think rebar is like 2% of the cost of a bridge or something like that.
Right. Great. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
So it's dangerous to put 2 crazy inventor guys on an airplane and put them. We were flying back from Chicago and we had 4 hours. And I asked hypothetically, how could we have prevented the Oklahoma City blast or mitigated the blast that killed all the people down there? And we realized that when a blast goes off, it's this dome. It's a shell that goes out like this. And we realized if we could catch the front edge of that dome, and as it's slamming in, take that energy and actually use its own energy as it's compressing in and actually turn it, we could take that energy and reroute the whole thing. And we, you know, as a technology company, we said, why don't we just build the darn thing and try it? And had to come up with the optimum thing to make that work. And boy, I wish this video would work, because let's see if we can get that lucky. No, so we'll have to get that too. There's an IED about 20 feet away.
I think someone's going to try to help.
I don't know how to. If we can, you want to? Thank you, Sky. And the blast range is out in Central Oregon, about an hour east of Bend. And the blast configuration that we can do through that lab is unlimited, and some of the blasts we actually have to ask let the FAA know that we're lighting it up, because it'll change the airway. And sorry, oh, no problem. Are we?
Sky?
Yeah. Okay, we'll click through. There we go.
Okay.
But the ability to invent something and then test it is something that's pretty unique here in Oregon. And the ability to take that and then push it into the marketplace and protecting critical infrastructure with different things like that. These blast shields, we started out making them steel, and then we transitioned to making them out of concrete. Our coating systems are on that to help bind the pieces together, and then the composite rebar is in there because it's a much stronger medium inside that as well. And that structure, you know, it's a, you know, say an 8 foot one weighs about 10,000 pounds. If you think of that semi that went through the southern France city that killed all the people and that kind of stuff, these kind of structures you could pick up with forklifts, move around. And if you have a critical event or something like that, you can pick them up and move them. But if someone lights up a car bomb, you can stop that. Bonneville Power Administration had a grant through the Department of Energy where they paid for half, we paid for half, and we actually did a whole range of tests where we did bullets and IEDs and EFPs and different structures like that. And we did a car bomb, you know, 250 pounds of high explosives from 6 feet away, and the blast shield moved about an eighth of an inch back and defeated all of that. So the ability to create a structure that would defeat that from a car bomb, you know, think of a Ryder truck pulling alongside of a building, you know, yeah. We have the ability to solve that. You know, that's part of what we do. So we'll go on here. When the grid was built, and we focused on the electrical grid as critical infrastructure, but when the grid was built, no one thought terrorism as part of the design criteria, whether domestic or foreign. And a lot of the design of the product or of the grid was for convenience and tucking it right into the communities and easy to, you know, for maintenance and things like that. Every site is unique. And so you have to look at each site and say, what would be the threat? Is it a car bomb? Is it a high-powered rifle? Is it a, you know, sniper from, you know, an apartment complex or something like that? So you actually have to have a menu of technologies that you can look at protecting critical infrastructure. And please, if you have any questions, you know, I would be honored to answer them. So I figure you're not very bashful people, but we'll we'll go forward here. So this was a site that we actually were asked to evaluate, and it's a nuclear plant down in Arizona, and they were trying to protect the transformers at that site. So we were actually asked to go in and walk through the site and figure out what made business sense for that. Part of the marriage of having a ballistics lab as part of our group is we can actually do threat assessments, evaluations, take a known load, a known shape, and actually do evaluations and see what would be the kill radius or what would be the damage radius of that facility. So that's part of the design and the threat assessment that we can do here. This is a great project that I'm very proud to say we built here in Oregon. It was in Columbus, Ohio. It's actually a substation, a superstation, one of the largest ones in the nation, and it was the first one ever to be protected from a whole range of threats in one shot. This happened in 2014, and the criteria was bombs, bullets, 120 mile an hour tornado winds, 2200 degree fire, earthquake, and it also had to be easy to assemble and disassemble. That was the design criteria. Okay, that didn't exist, and so we actually invented the technology here. In June of 14, it was on yellow notepads, and it had to go live November 1, and the last panel got dropped in on Halloween about 11 o'clock. Not a lot of sleep in that last couple of weeks, but we were able to successfully do that. Every form of power generation, think of nuclear, wind, solar, everything, has to dump into the grid. And the substations is the key point that goes. So you don't even have to attack the nuclear site. You attack the transformers. These transformers will you know, shut off big chunks of the grid if you take them out. In the packet that I gave you, there's an article that the Eugene Register Guard did. They did a really great research article about this project. And there's 700 superstations in the United States that has something like 70% of all the power running through them. Mm-hmm. And if you can take 9 or 10 of those out in a coordinated effect, you could shut down the U.S. economy. It's that dramatic.
Not that we're recommending anybody who's watching to take that with it. But hypothetically.
Yeah, hypothetically, yes. Thank you, sir. But I just want to say, when you realize, you know, that transformer is the soft belly button to our economy. You take out these and you black out chunks of the nation. And so that's in a critical part of it. So this structure started out with just a ballistic request, and so we created an airflow that let bullets or let airflow go through, but no bullets go through. And then they upgraded it to a blast, fire, earthquake, tornado, wind, and the whole superstructure became dialed in that way. The testing, you know, all of these components actually had to have UL testing and ballistic and blast and fire testing, and those were done here in Oregon as well. And then that's out in Central Oregon, and I don't think our video is going to work on this, but again, we'll get a copy of this to everybody if they're so inclined. That's a big car bomb. The requirement for this requirement, the structure, was a huge car bomb at a given distance, and I can't talk about the distance pretty openly at this point, but it's a big car bomb. And then this is my favorite video, and if it worked, it tells a story. That's Black Butte in the back corner there, yeah. About an hour east of Bend. That video shows the shockwave of the thump coming in, impacting the structure. It survived the event, and that was the high speed of that same big thump that we had. So I'm going to hand it off to this point because we were the technology innovation part. Now Lauren gets to go in and talk about that.
So I have a question. So you were talking about those walls where they deflect the blast. I mean, is the long-term opportunity there to actually design that into the buildings? Because this whole thing, I appreciate being able to move it to a location, but in many cases, since the blast is hitting the bottom part of the building, so is a long-term opportunity to do that?
Yes, sir. The physics are correct. If you design it in the structure, you could do it at the beginning of the structure as well. So retrofit and both new and used at that point.
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
So two questions. One on sort of when you design out like this, and you've got a rebar type product, is that really designed for concrete type foundations or concrete buildings? Can it be used with other materials? And I ask because we're building buildings now, or we're piloting a building around like cross laminated timber. How does this fit in with different types of building materials, or is it just like what you get is what you get?
Sure. The rebar, you know, concrete is incredibly strong in compression, and it's terrible in tensile. And so to make a long structure, you have to have rebar as the rib cage in there. Wood fiber does a very similar thing. You have long fibers, and when you cross-ply them that way. So wood fiber does a similar function. They're two different technologies, two different structures that way.
Okay. Yeah. And the second question I have has nothing to do with this piece of it specifically, but you know, when you're talking about growing an industry like this in Oregon, I also serve on the education committee. I mean, what's the workforce development type needs to have people who can go into and support your industry?
Okay. This is a fledgling industry, the critical infrastructure protection, and I want Oregon to be the heart of that. In my wish long term, all of your STEM programs, you know, your that's a critical part, the critical engineering, the understanding of the physics. It's pretty exciting when you show the children or the kids at a high school the physics of a blast and how you deal with something like that. The ability to take current horsepower, like Lauren's casting capabilities, and the ability to take that and then be able to take innovative technologies and pull that into his horsepower, that's actually the future of a lot of this as well. But your STEM programs, I think, is the strongest thing, and then being able to have the manufacturing capabilities of using that technology.
So is that like engineering and construction? I mean, it's...
Yes.
So just to back up just a little into your question, at the college level, of course, it's structural and civil engineering is what we need. But if you go back to the high school level, what we are most in need of right now is not so much engineers, but we need kids coming out of high school that know how to read a tape measure and know how to use power tools and know how to do some simple layout and who are strong, hard workers.
If I could ask the question, I think that will help explain part of what I think Representative Parrish is getting at as well. How many companies were involved in the Ohio Project, and how many workers laid a hand on it? Just what's the scale of this?
18 Oregon companies and 6 Southwest Washington companies touched that. Mm. And there were probably 400 people in the entire network that touched this project.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. He lifted my stick, so the video is going to go live here.
Well, fortunately, I'm a little leery of high tech, so that's why I'm now on the industry.
It's okay.
I have some pictures, so if you look,
pictures are good.
Your Knife River brochure there, you'll see a little bit of what we do. This picture is the picture of the barriers that Representative Lively was questioning us about, and yes, we would be happy to help design and construct buildings that are made to withstand bullets and bombs and fires and all the rest of that. It's certainly within our capability to do that, and our civil engineers and structural engineers were mm-hmm. a key component in this partnership that we had to design the structural part of it that helps it hold up, stand up against the threats that are out there.
I could jump in a comment. The threat criteria for that site in Columbus, Ohio, to meet all of the things they're asking for historically would be about 9 inches of concrete. We were able to take our technology and his horsepower and invent a new concrete armor that we did it in 3 inches.
Okay.
Mm. And we went to 4 just for wind load. But 3 would have met the criteria. So a whole new generation of concrete armor was invented for this project, and that could be ported into these structures as well.
Structures.
So another low-tech piece of paper here in your packet shows the actual picture of the modular building that goes around, or the structure that goes around these key infrastructure areas like power generation. And this is a modular system. You can see that it's got columns that bolt right to a footing, and then it's got panels that slide in and out. So if there is an actual explosion or something happens, you slide the old one out, slide the new one in. It can be adjusted to any size, any shape of threat need, any electrical substation, any communication building, anything that's part of a important part of our infrastructure can be protected like this.
Representative Meek, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Those structures, are those I-beams or what type of material?
Yeah, unfortunately, since we don't have our slideshow, we can't show you the guts of those. Those are just concrete columns.
Concrete columns.
And we manufacture those in the plant, and then they have grooves in either side of them, and you bolt them into place, and then you just slide the panels down in the grooves and put a cap on the top of it.
Oh, follow-up, Chair. For engineering details, how high of a structure can you build with this material?
That one was 30 feet tall and 85 feet long. And it's all based on a civil engineering requirement. If they needed to be taller, you'd have to have a bigger footing. Mm-hmm. But really, it's all based on how big a superstructure you're trying to do to protect. 30 feet is a pretty, a three-story building. That'll cover almost everything that most of the nations need that way.
And you'll notice all 4 of the walls here are freestanding. So they are independent of each other. And so that's why it's such a beefy structure. If we could actually connect all that and make it one structure, you could do a lighter column, a less expensive column. But this is made to withstand a lot of force. So,
and it's open in the corners to allow airflow because the transformers have to stay cool. And so there's a design criteria requirement for coolness in that superstructure. Let's get to your...
You want to go back and see if you can have that explosion?
I don't think it's live.
Still not going to work.
There it is. There it
goes. Uh-huh, I saw movement.
Here we go.
There it is.
Ooh. Oh, that's crazy.
And it's still
I'll play
there.
That again.
Look at that flash going across.
So that's a massive car bomb. Yeah, that thump. And so we had to validate the design, the new concrete, the structure. And the only way to validate something is thump it as hard as it's going to get thumped if it was in real life.
Some of our competition around the country is still trying to build these with furnace concrete, the kind of concrete you'd use in a furnace, and their walls are 8 or 9 inches thick and much heavier and much more expensive to manufacture. So you got another explosion for
we
us.
Got I was trying to get this one to work.
This is really the fun part of the presentation. Anyway,
so. And I don't think we got lucky with that one, okay, so we'll go with that.
That's good.
Yeah.
So this these next slides are actual production of the vessel wall system in our plant in Harrisburg. You see the top left is we're manufacturing the fiberglass cages, and then the bottom left you put the cage in the pan in the form and cast concrete on it, and then there's a bunch of them in storage in the top right, and the bottom left is the tent that we actually apply the coatings. We haul them in there, apply the coatings, and let them cure out of the weather.
Just to confirm, the cages, is that C-bar or is that?
C-bar. The composite rebar we were talking about earlier is exactly that.
Okay.
And the reason we chose that, one, it's stronger, but steel bends at a much more dynamic rate than concrete does. Concrete doesn't bend much. The composite rebar bends at the same rate, so it becomes a homogeneous structure that resists better. If they bend at different rates, that's where it fractures and all the concrete starts chipping off and things like that.
Thank you.
But also, I don't think that your count of 17 companies included the company that provided the plastic clips to put these together. But most of the time, rebar is tied together with steel wire, and in this case, we put it together with plastic clips.
18.
And these actually keep the panel from conducting electricity, which is very important in this environment.
Representative Lively, go ahead.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious, with your Harrisburg plant, and I've been around a long time, and I know there have been a lot of products, so major changes to your plant to be able to do this, or is this you accommodate it within your existing?
No, we accommodate it within our existing structure. It didn't take much of a change. What it did take was a real brain trust to engineer the product and to make it work and to test it so that we would know that it withstand. Oh. Part of the beauty of this is when a bullet strikes it or a explosion hits it, there's no shrapnel either. It collects the shrapnel and the bullet inside the structure, and so you don't get this massive blast of shrapnel that hurts people on the outside either. So that's actually the production process.
So when I came to the program and I talked to Lauren and his engineering team, I said, I've got 734 of these horizontal panels and 130 of these columns, and I'm going to need them in about 8 or 9 weeks. And the production manager looked at me and went, okay. I didn't even dent their day shift, okay? And how many factories do you have in your arm's reach, you know, at least in Oregon and Washington?
Depends on what kind of plants.
True.
Precast, we just have 5 plants, so.
So Swing Shift Graveyard and 4 other facilities, I don't think I could even dent his ability to produce this as an Oregon product that could go out into the world. And I'm proud to say that. This was not a brand new program, brand new technology, brand new, you know, structure. I'm really proud how quickly this came together, and their brain trust really rocked on this to make this work. I never want to learn what they already know in making concrete. They, you know, I can throw my brain cells elsewhere.
It was also economical enough that we actually built it here and shipped it via truck to Ohio to erect. So if you want to go to the next slide.
88 truckloads, by the way. Yeah.
So there's the column actually being constructed. Representative Meek, you asked about that. Those are the actual columns. The base plates on those weighed about 600 pounds, I believe,
right.
700 pounds. And then these columns are actually made with steel reinforcing, so they had to be connected to the electrical system on the other end to manage the electrical currents.
And all the horizontal panels that would take the load. Yeah. So these columns, just they were 24-inch square. That's just to give you a magnitude. And 13,000 pounds is what each one weighed.
And you see them going on the truck there. And this is the actual erection at the job site itself. And you can see the columns sticking up around the electrical station there. And if the video works, I believe it actually shows how easy these go together. There's a crane, and he's actually constructing So he's actually putting in a panel, and it's just going to slide down the grooves. So a total erection on this job could have been done in less than a week's time. We took a little longer because they weren't quite ready for us when we got there. So, but this doesn't take long to put up.
And then there's a cap that goes on the top. In Ohio, you have a freeze-thaw issue, and you have to make sure that the moisture doesn't get added down into it. So there's a cap that goes over the top of it. Remarkable piece, the first one of its kind in the world, superstation protected to this level. And I'm proud that this was an Oregon-based product and Oregon jobs that were created from that. This is what it looks like on the inside. And if that transformer lights up, there's 30,000 gallons of mineral oil that's the coolant that circulates to keep it cool. If that lights up, that's a 2,200-degree fire for days. And so we actually have a fire-blocking coating, the one we were talking about earlier, on the inside of that concrete. And then on the outside, we have our special coatings that lock the faces of that down for blasts and bullets. So it's an engineered thing. The underneath of that is actually a bathtub that we created with our coating to create it. If they actually had a penetration and an oil spill, they could catch it and cordon it off into another area and not let that sit as a pool that would burn up as well. And then each of these, when the grid was built 50 years ago, Eisenhower time frame, many of these transformers are aging at that rate. If they die, they explode like 20 pounds of TNT, and they'll take their neighbors out. So you actually had to have a fire block and an explosion block between the panels as well, so that you're protecting the block, the range of transformers that way. This just gives you an idea of the magnitude of that structure. And it's sitting in just about 20 miles outside of Columbus, Ohio, if anybody ever wanted to see what this was. 88 truckloads worth. It's a heck of a structure. Mm-hmm. And from the ground, you wouldn't know that that's a superstation. Yeah. That's what it looks like. So the next part of this that we have is, doing the threat assessment and the evaluations, we can say, here's a known explosion, here's a known threat, here's a known structure. How could you evaluate that and protect that? And because every site is unique, what we realize is you have to have a menu of technologies, not just a single one-size-fit-all, because every transformer station and every sewer station is different. You have to look at what is critical infrastructure. Also things like bridge cables, those are considered, if you pop those, mm-hmm. three or four of them will take down a super bridge, a suspension bridge, mm-hmm. things like that. So every one of them, you have to say what makes sense for that site and the ability to analyze it and then create a menu of technologies that can solve that. And this is a project that we have going on in the Iowa area, where they have a whole bunch of spaced far apart things, and they have car bomb potential threat and bullet threat, and then tornado winds. That's their biggest potential in that as well. These are different louvers that we created, where you actually have airflow that has to go around them. You could create just a straight armor that we created that's a louvered armor that could be part of that structure. And that's the shot that way. I think the thing that's really, really, for me, the most important in this is that this is Oregon-based technology and Oregon jobs. And for me, jobs are the great equalizer. If you have a job, you're adding to the pot. If you don't, you're taking out of the pot. And to actually create a group of companies, it's a mini cluster, in essence, is what we created. Mm-hmm. We ad hoc, we kind of fell back into it, but we created a mini cluster that is infrastructure protection that is Oregon-based. And if we said his Harrisburg plant, if we shot up and down the I-5 corridor, how many substations and how many critical points could we protect just coming up I-5 out of Oregon? I think that's an important part of this as well. Yep.
Yeah, what's exciting to me about this is there's nothing theoretical about this. This is real world, real life stuff. As you are probably aware, there was an attack on a San Jose, California, just south of San Jose, California, there was a guy that shot 150 rounds into a transformer station, took out 17 transformers and brought part of the grid down for an extended period of time. The cost is about $4 or $5 million an hour, which is about the cost to go out and install one of these. So the cost is relatively small. This is not experimental. This is real life stuff. We can actually build and protect these key infrastructure points.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair Evans. With the technology, I see it as for protecting infrastructures or vital resources. Do you see an application with maybe some of our seismic upgrading or construction policies to basically help us prepare in the future? I see this very strong materials and applications, and have you gone into any of that type of research?
So what you have to say is each site is unique. So if seismic becomes the dominant criteria, mm-hmm. then you focus on that. If there's seismic and a car bomb, potential threat or bullets. You know, a high-speed rifle 300 or 400 yards out, you could shoot up these transformers from that far away and not, you know, don't even have to get near the thing. You know, fences don't slow the things down like that. So it's all based on what the threat is. Mm-hmm. And if it's seismic is the dominant threat, then you key on that, and then you can add other things to that. Mm-hmm. And it's all based on what you're trying to do with that site. The materials that Knife River has, you know, their capabilities for seismic upgrades and the ability to retrofit structures and things like that is unparalleled. They're mm-hmm. best in class. That's why I chose to be their strategic ally in this. Yeah.
So part the answer to that is yes. A lot of what we're learning through building these and investigating new technologies is actually going in. Again, it's not theoretical anymore. We just finished two schools in the Beaverton School District that are mm-hmm. built not with steel reinforcing, but with carbon fiber reinforcing that we've used to make those schools stronger and safer. And they are also insulated in our plant, so you don't have to do that at the job site. So there's a lot of new technologies that will help all of the infrastructure in the state as we move forward.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious. So I appreciate the focus on Oregon and trying to do as much as we can here.
Sure.
I love that. But obviously, you didn't just start this. I mean, it took some investment in that. I'm just trying to understand how long it took to get to the point that it sustained itself, or does it sustain itself?
It does.
Okay.
The Battle Jacket program, we actually have six companies here in the Willamette Valley.
Okay.
So High Impact Technologies was a spin out of one of them
okay.
that focused on the Battle Jacket. And because we had day jobs in the other companies, we said, why don't we
okay.
take the money that we earned from the Battle Jacket, dump it back into new technology development and new critical technologies. And not very often you get to do that.
Yeah.
And so we've self-funded the entire time in this.
Really?
Yeah. The only time we've ever had any grants is the one with Bonneville Power Administration. And when the video, when you get a chance to see the car bomb going boom, it's pretty lively. But they paid for half, we paid for half, so both of us could use the data.
Oh,
and,
okay.
and so that was the only time we've had a grant
really?
in development.
You had to be congratulated. That's great.
Thank you. And, and still standing. That was 13 years ago when we started with the Battle Jacket program. It's still standing, and I'm proud to say that. Yeah. Oh. The other, if on a couple loose end notes of this, you know, in Oregon, we have these technologies being built here, but I do a lot of work abroad. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the UAE has more interest in critical infrastructure protection than we have here in Oregon, which is kind of sad because this mm-hmm. is all based right here in our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And this could be an industry that's anchored here that could fan out all over the West based in Oregon. And then Knife River has other locations around the country that we could take Oregon technologies and Oregon products and Oregon, you know, invoices and be able to move to the other locations where it made geographic sense.
Yeah, that's great. Because of time, I have to shut this part down. But before you go, there are a number of bills that may be moving forward, one specifically having to do with looking at available open public and nonprofit and even in some cases private space that's offered up for staging of pre-disaster, pre-catastrophe infrastructure. That task force, I believe, will be moving forward. There will also be, I believe, House Bill 2889, which talks about looking at the pipelines and tanker farms and trying to find ways to stabilize those. Again, your big brain solutions and proven experience in other places would certainly be welcome to be a part of both of those conversations, and we will make sure that you are at least aware of those. And the other 18 companies or other 16 companies that want to participate in that conversation, it would be nice to use Oregon as a demonstration of where we can protect our critical infrastructure and at the same time use Oregon companies maybe someday if we can put that together. So thank you very much for coming forward. I appreciate it.
If my last comment, if I could, sir, is in the back of the packet, there's pictures of different transformer stations. There's one that's on that side of the Capitol, and there's one that's on that side of the Capitol. Both of them are what supplies the power to the state agencies here locally, and I could throw a rock with my left hand and hit
sure
both of
could.
Them. So, you know, the reality is it's right here.
Could take it out with a rock.
Again, not that we're advocating that if anybody's watching.
That's right.
Thank you very much. A couple of comments. First, and I'll close the informational hearing. And again, you guys, you're welcome to hang out. We just have to do some business real quick. House Bill 2140, I believe. I understand that there's not a work group needed. Portland talked to me, you talked to me, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to schedule it for a public hearing and a possible work session next Tuesday. Okay. If anybody out there that was expecting a work group thinks they need to have that conversation, please talk to Representative Boone before Tuesday so we can try to move that down the road if we can. The other thing for Thursday coming up, this Thursday, not next Tuesday, but this Thursday, March 16th, we're planning on trying to at least move House Bill 2100 if the amendment gets back and the fiscal gets here so we can move it on down the road. Other than that, Bradley, if you'd like to tell people what we're planning on doing Thursday in addition to that, please.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. We're going to be having public hearings, possible work on House Bill 2847, House Bill 2887, and House Bill 2908. We're in the process of getting fiscal revenues on those. Whether we get them back or not completed, I'm not sure, but we will have public hearings. It looks like on four bills, and hopefully we'll have the fiscal revenues so we can have work sessions on as many as possible.
Okay, so we're going to be starting to move some things out. Last little asterisk for those that have not yet scheduled your work sessions. I talked to Representative Lewis today. I believe he and my chief, Evan, are going to be working to get you on the DPSST, your work group settled. I saw an email from the airport work group, and I know others are in the process of planning and staging. To the extent that we can help, please let me know. Again, two or three meetings to make sure we have an understanding of ground truth in that area is all we're trying to get to, and know how to work the future issues coming up. Any other things before we close out today? All right, well, thank you very much for your attention, and we will close this hearing of the House Committee on Veterans. Close this hearing of the House Committee on Veterans.